always just sets that thing to record, no matter what anybody is saying, and it's usually me, and it's usually unbroadcastable.
It's
anyway,
recording right now.
It's recording right now, isn't it, Stephen?
Yeah, red light.
It's not a very big red light. I know, size doesn't matter.
It's the motion in the ocean.
Now, we've moved. You'll be able to tell that from the relative silence in the background. We've moved from the Beehive, which was absolutely bloody gorgeous, but deafening. And I'm, you know, of a certain age, and I couldn't hear half of what anybody was saying, which kind of puts a spoke in the wheel.
As an audio medium, then the sound is more important than how it looks.
But, the blistering repartee for which the Slaughtered podcast is famous, it's kind of, as we say in Scotland, it's gas was put at a peep because nobody could hear what anyone else was saying. So we've come back to the Surgeon's Hall, Space at the UK, which is marvellous. They've got comfy seats. We've got a table to ourselves. We're in the press office, so there's a kind of hubbub behind us. That's the kind of hubbub you get when people are discussing how well their shows are doing.
Occasionally you get performers coming in having a bit of a drop, which I'm looking forward to.
Well, I know it could be. No, they're very nice performers here. However, à nos moutons, as the French say, it's because I'm intelligent and educated. I have a huge confession to make to the drop-dead gorgeous woman sitting on my right. I made a wee package, I thought, this will be hilarious, of shows at the Fringe that had funny titles. And almost always, if somebody calls their show something ridiculous, it's because the actual show is shite. And, you know, they just want to get bums on seats. And by the time the bums are on seats, unless you're at the Free Fringe, people have paid. And they did. So I saw the title of a show, Attack of the 46 Triple G
Clickbait,
Woman.
I think is what they call it online.
But it, and I thought, well, this is going to be some kind of deeply disappointing, huge letdown, trick. And, I mean, in this day and age, I thought, oh, it's going to be a bloke, it's going to be whatever. And I went along to see the show, and it turns out it was blindingly brilliant. It is, for a start, you'll meet her in a minute, a woman with 46 triple G. Sorry, I'm slightly distracted by a man taking his clothes off. Does that happen to you all the time, Natalie? They just walk into the room, see your breasts, and start taking their clothes off.
All the time.
So this is Natalie. And she does have 46 triple G breasts, but she also is a ferociously brilliant stand-up. And in all my many, many decades at the Edinburgh Fringe, I think you just about do the darkest. Takes a lot to make me gasp, certainly. Wow. Since I've lost all feeling from the waist down, but it takes a lot to make me gasp. And everybody was just kind of sitting in the room going but, and I don't know whether it's because you're so sweet or because the breasts kind of act as some kind of calming influence, but whereas if a man was doing a lot of that material, people would be walking out and tutting, and, you know, the 12-year-old front of house staff would be saying they couldn't possibly work with you. But it's like a magic trick. You do the darkest material I've ever heard, and in this voice. Have you always been that dark, or was this a fiendish plan?
I think I've always had a little bit of darkness, but I was maybe mostly light with just that little bit. And then maybe about a year ago, it sort of flip-flopped to maybe 90% dark, 10% of like sweetness and lightness. But I'm actually quite surprised that people here find me so edgy and dark, because I don't feel like that back in the States, that maybe people just don't take me seriously, or maybe they're not really listening.
Wow. But it's you're like, I don't know, you're not the sweet and sour of comedy, but you're so sweet and you're so nice, and you're very giggly, and your body language, I don't know whether it's your own body language or whether it's a fiendishly brilliant performance, but your body language is very little girl, and you curl your hair, and you, and then you're talking. I mean, I have never heard, I don't want to do too much of a spoiler for your show, because you have to go and see this show. I've never heard anyone rip into Anne Frank the way Natalie does.
That's quite something.
Wow. Now, there, we have somebody, he's being doing so professional. Just introduce yourself, tell us who you are, and then you can join in.
Then I can join in, okay, yeah. Great. So my name is Scott LaCrosse. I'm directing a production called Boff. That's on at Pleasance Below at 1:50 each day.
It's also a physically thing, isn't
it? Yeah, it's about a plus-size gay man who is in his mid-30s, becomes single, and it's about him navigating dating and fat phobia and kind of the pressures of looking a certain way. So that's what the piece is about.
I mean, do you find that the... I'm sorry, I'm staring there. I've had two poached eggs on my chest for as long as I could can remember. And I quite like that now, because people are, a lot of women my age go, oh, it costs a fortune to buy a bra. And I'm like, what's a bra? So it's quite good to have just two little poached eggs on your front. But when did these marvellous things kind of explode?
Well, I've always been somewhat busty, but I also have maybe gained some weight over the years also.
And did it all go to your breasts?
I mean, obviously not all, but I think I am kind of, it's starting to, like, the inmates are starting to run the asylum a little bit. it's a bit extreme. I'm used to it. My back doesn't hurt or anything. I feel like I'm just always kind of just carrying around like two very pendulous dinosaur eggs that are like, they're not heavy. I guess they must be heavy, but I don't feel.
Yeah. And do you, I mean, I would imagine that across Edinburgh, there will be men and obviously some women and other genders, other gender identities are available with terrible, like tertiary whiplash. Just, you know, if you've walked past them in the street, do you get used to be? Well, are you? I'm staring at you now. Everybody's staring at you now. Do you get used to that? Do you like it? Can you fiendishly use it to your advantage?
I think I'm a pretty oblivious person in my own way, and I usually I don't think I notice, but a while ago, I was having fondue with a friend at a restaurant, and there was this couple next to us, and the woman threw her drink at him. They were like, you know, an older married couple, and she said, "Stop looking at her breasts, Harold, second time," and I didn't notice.
Didn't notice.
You know, and I don't know if that's almost like a protective kind of thing where...
But I mean, I think it's fine if the look is admiring. Different if the look is a bit sleazy.
But obviously it goes beyond just people turning their necks around. You're using it as part of your act, as the title of the show.
Well, I can't exactly like go on stage without them. And if I don't address it, I think people, you know, just look at me like, does she know?
Yeah.
It's kind of a weird, I think when I was newer at comedy, people are like, oh, all you do is talk about your breasts. And it's like, no, I'm actually talking about different things. You're just not quite getting it.
Absolutely.
And then I'm like, okay, well, if you want me to talk about more serious things, I'll go there. I'll talk about everything.
I can't begin to tell you how dark and it's just brilliant. And I suppose that is, it's an ism. You know, people are banging on about, you know, homophobia and all of this. And you're not using the right pronouns. But people do also make half a dozen assumptions when a woman walks on a stage with breasts like those. I mean, I think they imagine you're not very bright, and I think, you know, and that's an ism, that's a phobia.
What time's your show on?
23:20.
Okay.
At the Space
Symposium.
Yeah. And then I switch later on in the month.
But it's.
So you have to give us a bit more than that to give people a flavour of what to what to expect without giving the game away.
How would you, because there's a great spread of material. Absolutely every hand gesture and word that you use just about develops a double meaning in your presence. It's a great spread. How do you describe it?
Well, I would say that without giving too much away, basically for me it's just about it's a little bit about my breasts, but it's mostly just me getting my revenge on the world, and especially on like the men who have wronged me. For me, it's actually quite a meaningful show, and I know that it's dark. It comes from a lot of pain that I've had in my life, and I think people could easily say, oh, this is, you know, you're just trying to be shocking, you're just trying to be offensive. But I think that I am really...
You've earned the right to tell these stories.
In some ways, and so the Anne Frank stuff, I think I maybe will have to explain a little bit more about that. So, because I don't have any any reason why would I be mean to Anne Frank. But basically, in my show, I kind of am talking about what is the point of having breasts this large, right? And then it's almost like they're not like these superpowers, right? But I try to think like, how could I use them for good? And my plan is to, you know, go back in time and try to seduce Hitler and stop the Holocaust. And since I'm going back in time, it's like I feel like I have this, you know, this kind of character. And it's like she wants to be a big star. And she goes to the Holocaust. And it's like, well, why is it all about Anne Frank? When is it going to be about me? And kind of making fun of this way that when there's like this tragedy, that I feel like there's so many artists that are like, oh, how can I benefit from this? How can I gain some clout? And I think I kind of play this role of like, oh, I'm jealous of Anne Frank. When obviously I wouldn't be jealous of Anne Frank. Also like, well, she's so thin and everyone loves her. And, you know, I'm going to go to the Holocaust and I'm going to be the fattest one and no one's going to like me. You know, that kind of, maybe to people that's shocking. And it's obviously not. I'm Jewish and it does kind of come from this, like, who's the worst man I can think of that I could bring down? And it would be Hitler.
It doesn't come out of nowhere, but the first half of the show is a bit more kind of disparate, but it's all incredibly funny. And then all of a sudden, there's this glorious, fully owned darkness. And, you know, it's a long time since I've heard gasps like that. You should see it.
I'm so intrigued. I'm really, really intrigued to see your show because... I'm sort of the sort of sitting in front of you and sort of seeing this. The presentation of you is very kind of sweet and light and sort of gracious. And then the fact that your material is so dark, I'm really intrigued. What can I ask you about your what sort of drew you to doing stand up and how did your journey begin? What was the course of that?
I feel like I've started quite late in life with stand-up. I didn't start till I was 30, so a few years ago. And I am quite like a soft-spoken person. Being on stage does not come naturally to me, really. I'm sure that you could tell. And I think people think, oh, she's pretending to be, you know, a little bit shy and awkward. And it's like, no, I'm pretending to be confident. And to other people, I think they're like, oh, this is a confident girl pretending she's nervous. No, I am more afraid of you than you are of me. I think I've been just kind of this person who held a lot of stuff in for a long time, and maybe psychedelics, a little bit of therapy. I dabbled in burlesque a little bit, but I would kind of like do something and then not do it again for a year. I would just like get this rush and then like retreat. And for some reason, just with stand-up, I did it. I didn't do it again for a year. And then when I kind of came back, it was just really the only thing that I felt like I just naturally was kind of good at. And I just kind of just had this like comedic sensibility. And I know that I'm not for everybody. I definitely know that. But I have a lot of clean stuff too. And
no,
it's not really fun for me anymore. Because I think once I got used to being on stage, that high kind of wore off. And now for me to like feel anything again. If I'm not feeling like I'm on that like tightrope... Yep. Then I feel like I might as well stay home and watch Bridgerton. I put on my heels and my eyelashes, you know?
So what did you want to be when you grew up?
Probably a a ballerina.
Whoa. No. That you did lessons?
No.
Oh, okay. No, so just
I was just
more
like
of an
a
idea.
Little chubby kid, but I guess if I could have been anything, it would probably have been, you know, something very girly, something very princessy. Yeah. I've never been someone, you know, maybe I think there might have been, and this is quite dark, but I might have at some point wanted to be like a doctor, but more because like I would want to like find the cure for cancer and then never tell anybody. Because like nobody ever took me seriously, so I was like, okay, well, there you go. Like, I will do all this great stuff and not share it with anybody.
Yeah, it's quite. I don't think anyone meeting you would even begin to guess at the darkness inside. I mean, not to lighthearted. Oh my God, I've just seen your shoes. Oh, they're fabulous! Big, oh, wow. Sparkly, gold bows.
Wow. And your toenails.
I do have like a little toenail design.
The woman is a fucking work of art.
Oh my God,
she
thank
is a
you.
Walking work of art. And you're such an extraordinary, can I use the word creature without you?
Yes.
You're such an extraordinary creature that I think in this, well, certainly me, because I'm a moody old bitch, you kind of think, well, this can't be right. You know, she's probably foul. The breasts will come off at night. And and then, you know, bump into you on North Bridge. And I'm thinking, you know, ha ha, now we'll see. And you're like, it's so nice of you to say that. That's just so lovely. It's just, oh, I'm so glad you like the show. And I'm like, oh, my God, this woman is for real. You were even wearing the leopard skin. Do you always wear leopard skin?
I have a few. Like, I kind of have a few moods.
Okay.
I do.
And today you're a leopard.
Yeah, just because I dress for the show after this, but I feel like I either do kind of like a whatever happened to Baby Jane look, or...
Now, are you Betty Davis or Joan Crawford?
Oh, I would say that I am Betty Davis.
Whoa. Again, dark.
I like the idea of a stand-up, and there's no shortage in Edinburgh of stand-ups who have got a bone to pick with the audience, but very few of them can pull it off. Very few of them can...
Well,
can,
she has a boner to pick with the audience, and she can definitely pull it off.
Yeah.
But it's... So, you came out of the not being a stand-up into being a stand-up kind of fully formed. This is your... I mean, because it's you, really, with a few tweaks and twiddles.
Yeah, I would say that if I weren't doing stand-up, like, I don't really write. I'm not even, like, a big comedy nerd. I don't watch a lot of comedy. I wouldn't say that there's, like, somebody that's really... I mean, there's definitely people that have inspired me, but I don't think that I've really, like, copied
that's
somebody.
Good. That is good.
I'm sure, you know, Dolly Parton or like Elvira. I love these kind of like larger than life women. But and Dolly Parton
now,
is dark.
You've met. You have rubbed breasts with Dolly Parton.
I have.
Wow.
I went to a concert and some woman had an extra like press pass out of nowhere, just ran and gave it to me and was like, do you want to meet Dolly? We have to go now. And you probably can imagine I'm not the best runner. And we had to run through this like whole auditorium and it was just like, pop, pop, pop. By the time I got to Dolly, I was like all red faced. I looked like a deranged, like horror. It was really just so unfortunate because I felt like if you know you're going to meet Dolly, you really.
Oh, yeah.
And I was just a mess. But, you know, you only really have like a moment with her. And I just stared at her like, what can you even say to this woman? And she's just like, you've got bigger boobs than me. And we hug and we go kind of like breast to breast. And I have a photo. And in real life, she's quite, like, she's not, like, a quite fully, like, normal size.
She's tiny.
She's like
she's
a Tinkerbell.
Tiny. Yeah.
She's like, and really, her breasts aren't, it's not that her breasts are so large, it's just she's just really so tiny. And so, standing next to her, because sometimes I really am like, what are people making such a big deal about? I see my breasts all the time. I don't think they're that big.
Okay, I'm here to tell you you're wrong. They're big.
I have a little bit of body dysmorphia, so sometimes I'm just like, oh, people are just making it up. They're just trying to be nice or mean. I don't know.
Wow. And you said you did a little interview for me for a magazine. You used to get bullied at school?
Yeah, but not even.
Did you have the boobs at school?
You know, I was friendly with the girl who had bigger breasts than me at school. And I don't think that anybody really noticed me. And I also think that it was, I mean, they must not have been quite, I've definitely like put on some weight. Mm-hmm. And I think that I was just, as a child, I was just very lonely, very sad. I pissed myself a lot. I understand why people would bully me. Like, it was probably, you know, I was
easy
not...
easy target.
Yeah, I was not quite... I mean, now, honestly, people don't really... I mean, to my face, everybody is very, very lovely to me. But, yeah, as a child, definitely was bullied a lot.
There's absolutely no way to segue. So I'm just going to say that being... having a lot of body... Mm-hmm. That's not really an acceptable thing in the gay world, is it?
Oh, not at all. Mm. Not at all. I mean...
Because there's that... What was that? The film, The Whale?
Yeah, exactly. Mm. I mean, but also, like, when you think about this, so there was a programme recently that was... I can't remember which channel it was on. And it was a gay dating programme. Uh-huh. And most of the people were, like, ripped on it and made to look a certain way, and the kind of the slightly more plus size people were paired up together, and it's like saying that someone who's of a certain
you're
size,
in the chubby ghetto.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that there's this huge focus on being sort of muscly and going to the gym and taking pictures of yourself in the gym,
and not just a little bit muscly but
like ripped,
yeah.
Like absolutely ripped. And it's really sad, because actually I think that what it does is it really exacerbates like things to do with mental health and things to do it's huge.
Because then if everything that you think or that you feel and are led to feel that is good about you is your gorgeous body, then as you get older, it is going to wither and die, and so you'll have nothing left to like. What do you think is going to happen to the boobs as you get older? Sorry.
Spoiler alert. I used to think, you know, like, how many good boob days do I have left in the world? But realistically, like they do not look like this.
Yeah.
You know, they're natural breasts and they're large, and it's honestly... I've never had particularly, like, perky, large breasts anyway. I know it's probably just going to all go, like, literally downhill from here. But,
Well, you'll always have something to cover your knees, you know, when you're sitting in a chilly room.
And I think, honestly, just from doing OnlyFans, it's really... Not that I'm worried about how I'm going to see myself, because I don't think any man will ever like me or anything. But, like, men like so many different things.
Yeah, that's true.
I will be 70 and somebody will be, like, Googling, like, 70-year-old woman giant breasts. And probably paying more.
Yes.
Because it's more, like, rare.
Yeah, men, straight men. I mean, thank heaven for them, because at least push comes to shove, they'll shag anything. But but they are.
I think the common denominator there is men.
Men.
It's really not men about men. It's not about how you feel
but
about
it's,
yourself.
It's, there's a much broader spectrum. I mean, you only have to look at OnlyFans. There's lots and lots of people there that don't fit women there that don't fit into the stereotype of gorgeous.
Yeah.
But the gay world is much more... Certainly,
There's a big phalanx of bears amongst the...
bears like bears.
But, also, like, I think that there's a thing like too smooth, too hairy, too big, too small,
too bold, too bearded.
Too bold, too bearded. I think there's so many things that people physically... feel that they... I also think part of the problem is people feel like they have the right to sort of comment on something so openly. Mm-hmm. And then that's part of the problem, is that it's like, it's okay for me to just say that I think that you're big, or I think that you're too hairy, or... I've had some awful experiences with people that I've met online, and the judgments and...
I'm speaking without experience here, but would it be more the case in the gay community where people are expected to and allowed to be more openly judgmental?
I think what it is that there are a lot. I mean, I probably, I don't know the kind of statistics of it, but like in terms of like apps and meeting people, it feels like there's a lot more, that there are more apps that are geared towards like meeting people to have sex.
Swiping left.
Yeah, swiping left and swiping right, or not, or not even that, just like photos. And then, and I think that that feels, people feel like they get, they've got the right to just comment so openly.
I mean, it's undoubtedly, at least partly, an age thing. But I don't buy anything online. I wouldn't buy a pair of shoes online. So, you know, much less go, ooh, marvellous, click, I'll be shagging you. It's, I mean, you've got the OnlyFans page. Is it, you like your OnlyFans fans, don't you? It sounds like you're having quite a good experience.
I am, but I would say that I also know that, like, sometimes I don't post anything for months. Like, I just am a little bit, like, kind of whimsical, and it's hard for me to, like, stick to a routine. But I've definitely met some cool people, and I'm always, I guess, a little, people have been mostly respectful. My OnlyFans is quite mild, so I know there's a lot of people who are disappointed, and they unsubscribe, and that's fine, you know? But I know I wouldn't, like, push it on other women. I wouldn't say, oh, this is a great thing to do. I kind of feel like, you know, who knows, in maybe a year, I'll be like, oh, I wish I never would have done that.
Yeah. I mean, I know I've got a lot of friends in porn world, hardcore porn, and all of them, but especially the women, are loved. They were like the first on OnlyFans, and they love it because they control it.
Exactly.
There's nobody saying, right, now do that, now do this. They are controlling it totally, and it's theirs, and they're getting, and also it's good for their fans who only get to see them, you know, dangling by their nipples from something in some porn film that they've had to pay a lot for online. Okay, they pay for the OnlyFans, but they kind of, it's weird, but a lot of the guys feel that they've got more of a relationship. They're not just watching and wanking. Yeah.
It feels personal.
Yes. And I mean, I do, and with people like you who are kind of extending the reach, the parameters of OnlyFans, which is you can get whatever you want, but you can also get something which is a quasi online relationship with a woman with the kind of boobs you've spent your entire life dreaming about. And I mean, it does sound from, you know, what you say in your show and whatnot, that it's not a horrible relationship. It's not a horrible experience to do the OnlyFans stuff.
No, it's not horrible at all. I can't claim that it is. I think for me, sometimes I spent a lot of my life just feeling totally invisible. And in some places I am. In some places I walk into a room, I am not most people's type. This is a very specific type. This is not for everybody. This is maybe like a novelty, I think, for a lot of people, but this is not like the standard. And I think there are some people that definitely, like, this is a fetish. And so,
yeah, I hadn't really thought of that, because you're not a novelty inside, you know. This is getting deep, but I suppose something as fantastical and fabulous as your boobs must get in the way of you, if you know what I mean.
I'm kind of just always living in my own shadow, in a sense. Sometimes, I mean, I can't quite, like, if I could Photoshop myself and be like, oh, this is what I would look like as a 32A or something, I mean, maybe I would have had a totally different life, who knows?
But you're certainly making it work. I do feel not a little bit ashamed. I'm not into feeling ashamed, you know, whatever. I do feel a little bit ashamed that I saw the sort of the poster, and I saw it, and I thought, oh, this will be a bit trashy. And it's one of the best stand-up shows I've ever seen in my whole life. Partly because of the darkness, and you got this, you know, the voice is there, and it's just so lovely, and the boobs are there, and the thigh is there, and then you're going into this stuff that makes Jerry Sadowitz sound like Michael McIntyre, and it's a glorious, glorious combination.
It's to do with the ownership as well. You're taking ownership over the things that you're saying. So therefore, actually, there's something about it that feels quite powerful. And I think that's what it sounds. I mean, I'm really desperate to see your show now because it sounds wonderful. And I really like comedy that really goes...
It's unexpectable. And there was... The night I saw it, it was very early on, and there were some quite leery lads down at the front who had obviously come for the boobage. There was the leery lads at the front, and there was kind of like a strange mix. And certainly the leery lads were leading the way with, oh, yeah. But they really kind of settled down to appreciate the comedy. And they were, you know, when it got dark, they were like, and you're going to make a festival going Larry Lager lad gasp. Mm. You are going some.
Yeah.
So your piece is a play.
Yeah, it's a play. So it's a one-man play. And the way that it's written is the style of it is that the character is talking to other people and you imagine what the responses are.
Okay.
So stylistically it's quite interesting because he talks to a whole range of people. He talks to his housemate, he talks to his ex, he talks
and
to...
He's and he's a big guy.
Yeah, he's a big guy.
What's the name of the play?
Buff.
Buff.
Yeah. B-U-F-F. Sometimes my accent sounds a bit sort of like...
I know, because I was like, buff. I thought, oh, poof. No, I don't...
It should be called that, maybe.
Buff, so, poof.
But it's very, very interesting because I do a lot of one-person shows and stylistically it's unlike something I've done before because the audience become everybody else that he's talking to. He's a primary school teacher, so the audience become a counselor.
So
No, I've directed it. Okay. Yeah, yeah.
He's worked with Maureen Lipman.
I have.
Yes. On Rose.
Yeah. And that was a one-woman show, and that was very different. Very different.
Oh, indeed, yes.
But that was very different.
Well, she's a very slim woman for a start.
She's a very slim woman, yes. But with Rose, it was very, very different in terms of the fact that it was more about storytelling. So the characters that she was talking about, she sort of slightly embodied them.
Mm-hmm.
She sat on a bench for 2 hours, sitting shiver.
Phenomenal actress.
Phenomenal actress and wonderful to work with.
Really?
And the level of kind of detailing and care that went into the performance and just because it's so it's about a survivor, it's about a Holocaust survivor. And she talks from her birth growing up in Ukraine, interestingly.
Mm-hmm.
And then it comes, the play ends just before the millennium, the turn of the millennium.
Wow.
So she's kind of sitting shiver and she's retrospectively looking back on her life.
It's more than a line, but the space between one person plays and kind of stand-up that incorporates quite a lot of storytelling and then gets into the the deep stuff.
Yeah.
That line, just especially if it's a comedy one-person play, it looks like it's nothing, but it's a massive gap. And at one point, I remember somebody saying to me about how, you know, Natalie is a character. And there's a lot of people do character comedy.
Yeah.
But I would be interested to see if somebody could...
Bridge that gap.
Yeah.
I think for me, I'm quite interested in work that that sort of does try to bridge that gap. That stuff that I'm very interested as a director in work that's about the actor and the audience and about how you kind of really connect with people.
Mm. Yeah. And but it's scary.
Yeah.
If
it's terrifying.
If you've been an actor and then you're doing stand up, it's terrifying.
Yeah.
I think, you know.
Well, you're not pretending anymore.
Because you've got no excuses, you know, and you've not it's not the character, it's not been badly directed.
Yeah.
It's you, they don't like you.
Well, there are,
basically,
there are a lot of shows where the premise of the show or the play is pretty thin, but with a performer that has heft, then they can, you know, they can bring it to life.
Yeah.
And as a stand-up, if you've got what might seem, you know, a frivolous title and you know, a premise that people go in thinking one thing and then they come out thinking another. It's heft. It's made to happen.
Absolutely, it's really, it's a unique comedy experience in all my experience, and it's, I think it's a wonderful thing to come out going, well, I didn't think that was going to happen, because, again, because of everybody wants to sell, they're all busy saying, oh, here's what somebody said. I noticed the little thing on your flyer. 5 stars, the Scotsman, this woman. 5 stars. And then what was the quote you chose?
Gloriously appalling.
Gloriously. She is gloriously appalling, but she is so much more. I mean, that was very kind of, what's the word? You were holding back. I mean, I said a lot of lovely things. It was me that wrote it, by the way. But it was, oh, I just thought it was exceptional. And how have you been doing for audiences?
Well, I haven't sold out yet. I have not been flyering maybe as well as I should have been. But I think that so this is my first time at the Fringe, and I didn't think I quite understood, like, when I thought people came here, I didn't realize they come with, like, maybe a director and a producer and all this stuff.
No, as soon as I assume complete control, that won't be allowed. But carry on.
And so I just kind of, I just want my show to reach the people that it's for. And I don't want people to come in and they think it's the Barbie movie and it's Schindler's List. And I do think most people have really loved it. And sometimes I think people are going to laugh and they end up crying. And in a good way. Or, you know, sometimes people are moved by something in a way that I didn't expect. But I've also had 2 people walk. And that's pretty good.
Men or women?
Men.
Whoa.
Last night. And so I think...
What bit did they walk at?
They made it to almost towards the end.
Right.
And wow. And they weren't rude about it. And I think maybe it just wasn't a good match. And I tried... I liked my flyer. I struggled.
I love your flyer.
I kind of just based it on the movie Attack of the 50-Foot Woman.
Yeah. And I think if your show's on the edge, you have to expect you would want a couple of people to walk.
Yeah.
Because then you know that you're on the edge.
Yeah, although the edge is... Oh, God. I mean, nowadays, young people. The edge is pretty far inland nowadays. Mm. But so you said... the people that the show is for, who are they?
I think people who are a little bit, you know, twisted, but who have, like, good hearts. people who are smart, but maybe not necessarily in this, like, very, like, intellectual kind of snobby way. I think my show could be for everybody, and I think sometimes I have a weird Venn diagram of fans sometimes, but I just, I don't want to ruin anybody's night. I don't want somebody coming and having a bad time. I don't think that I guess it never really occurred to me that I was that, that I was like that naughty. And now I'm just like, oh gosh, like I don't think I'm like a shocking comedian because I want to upset people. I really genuinely wish that everybody in the world would love my show.
Well, I mean, that is the thing. When you see it, it's not the darkest material. None of it is done in the way that dark material is normally done, which is, okay, I'm going to, you know. It's just, and it's genuinely like she's having this wonderful idea that she's very enthused about, and it's going to make the world a better place in retrospect. And it just so happens that it's...
Can I ask to what extent does your show here overlap with your regular stand-up in the States?
I've been working on kind of this more like gallows humor, Holocaust, like Seduce Hitler set for just about a year. Mm-hmm. And I don't necessarily, if I'm opening for someone else, if I know that they're dark and they wouldn't mind, I'll do it. But I totally also understand if that's not what they want, I don't do it. I feel like I've never had... too many people feel that I can maybe count on one hand the number of times that somebody sat there with you know, kind of an angry face, but then I think just like the laughter of hundreds of people versus like the anger of one person,
and they undoubtedly came in with an angry face.
But I know this is not for everybody. I totally know. But I think that it's for more people than you would think.
Pretty much nothing wonderful is for everybody.
Mm. And does your comedy translate, do you feel, like transatlantically, like in terms of a British audience and an American audience? Do you feel like, have you had to kind of adapt certain bits of your material, or does it all land? Are there bits that you go, actually, that doesn't work so well here?
Maybe just like names of certain shops or neighborhoods that I've gotten used to saying jokes in certain ways. But I would think that so far, it could also be my venue, that it feels a little less like a comedy club.
Yeah, it doesn't feel at all like a comedy club.
I didn't quite know what I would, like, maybe I should maybe next time be in a venue that's a little rowdier, a little darker. I feel like I'm giving almost like this TED Talk. But I think that maybe audiences here, I feel like, have felt a little bit more, a little bit tighter.
Wow.
And a little bit more like...
Have you done any guesting on Best of the Fest type shows?
No, not yet.
Oh, we need to fix that.
Oh, yeah.
We definitely need to fix that.
It's a great way of bringing in people as well.
Absolutely. So, just before we disappear, your show is where and when? 5 Stars, The Scotsman.
It's at the Space UK at 11:20, and the last week of the Fringe, it's at 10:40. I can't. I'm a genius, but I can't do the time.
That's fine. That's close enough. Just get there, queue up, go in, love it. And
Buff is 1:50.
Ooh, lunch. Lunchtime.
Yeah, lunchtime. Pleasance Below.
Have your lunch beforehand.
Have your lunch beforehand. Come and see it. It's 50 minutes.
Nice.
So,
who's your actor?
Brilliant actor called Piers Egan,
mm-hmm.
Who was recently in a Netflix film called Infamous Side.
Ooh.
Piers is a lovely Irish actor who does some stand-up as well. So again, I think it sort of crosses over in about how to kind of bridge stand-up and acting. So yeah,
fantastic.
1:50.
Wonderful. Absolutely bloody marvellous. Now we basically set up this little extra podcast just for you, Natalie, and then you were hanging about outside.
Loitering
about outside. Not even flyering, can I say. He's not even got the excuse. But you've both been absolutely worth it. Thank you very much. We'll see you later.
Thank you so much. Thank you.